This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Every gardener knows the frustration of seeing a perfect plant bed overrun by weeds. Now imagine what it must be like to see an entire lake or an entire field fill up with an unwanted plant, and you'll understand a little of what it's like to work with invasive species. New Hampshire has classified several dozen plant species as invasive, from the decorative and terrestrial Japanese barberry to the much-reviled aquatic milfoil. State officials and environmental groups have seen some successes in the fight against invasives, but much like the weeds in a garden, keeping these species at bay is not a one-time effort. Today in The Exchange, the offensive against invasives. Later on the show, we'll look at what the state is doing to stop the spread of insects such as the emerald ash borer or the Asian longhorn beetle. But to start, we look at these invasive plants and New Hampshire's efforts to keep them in check. And let's hear from you. Do you have invasives in your part of the state? What, if anything, is being done about them? And what more would you like to know about these species? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can share your comments and questions on Facebook. Joining us for this portion of the program is Doug Sagan, Invasive Species Coordinator for the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. Welcome.
Good morning, Brady.
And Amy Smagula is with us, Limnologist and Exotic Species Program Coordinator for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Good to see you.
Hi, Brady. Good to see you.
This can be a frustrating struggle. We get a plan in place, and then these species just keep on coming.
They do keep coming. That's one of the problems with invasive plants is they keep reproducing, they keep being spread either by mechanical means through movement of earth material, through waterways, river channels, things like that. We have Japanese knotweed, which is taking over a lot of different areas throughout the state. We have other invasive plants like glossy buckthorn, which is detrimental to wildlife. The problem just keeps persisting.
They persist and they take over. Those are two terms, Amy, that you just don't like to hear when we're talking about plants in the state.
This is very true. And when they do come in, they tend to form a monoculture, which is just one of all the same species either taking up the landscape or taking up the water column or the lake bottom. And that is absolutely to the detriment of native species that are trying to fight against them to save an inch of habitat.
So they would, say, grow a little bit taller than the native plants, a little bit more close to the sun, or simply take over the habitat so that the more common native plants can't do what they normally do.
That's exactly true. A lot of the invasive species tend to have competitive advantages that allow them to grow faster, grow to the surface, grow tall and canopy out anything beneath them. Some of them also produce chemicals that inhibit other plants from growing near them or animals from eating them. So they're pretty savvy little invaders that just tend to take over.
And because they're invasive, they're not traditional, there's no native defenses or native plants or animals to try and keep them in check. So
correct.
That's where we have to come in.
Correct. In their home country, they're not considered invasive. Here we have plants like poison ivy, which are considered a noxious weed. When we have invasive plants coming in, there are no predators, parasites, diseases, pathogens to keep them in check. And that's the problem. They run rampant. They produce thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of seeds. And those seeds are highly viable. And they can persist in the soil for 10 to 15 years in some cases. Other plants, you know, they'll just sit there and they'll wait. Glossy buckthorn, first thing that will happen when you're doing a forested clear-cutting area is glossy buckthorn will take over very quickly.
They sound a little bit like supervillains, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah,
but let's take a look at the big picture. How would you say we're doing today in trying to deal with or at least cope with some of these persistent invasive species compared to, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
I think we're doing great. I think we're doing a wonderful job. I myself, working for the Department of Agriculture, we started an invasive plant control initiative where we're getting out and we're doing invasive plant eradication on a statewide level. Most of my work entails integrated pest management, which is dealing with mechanical, biological, chemical control methods. We have purple leaf-stripe biocontrol measures that are out there. We've released over 1 million beetles. Last year, I was able to hit about 47 acres of Japanese knotweed with about 90% control, which I think is phenomenal. About 7,000 woody invasive plants under control just from last year. The year prior was probably about half that rate. So we're doing great work. We have different agencies working for Department of Agriculture, Department of Transportation, different towns and communities that are also doing a lot of outreach education work and doing mechanical controls and biological controls as well.
Amy, we talked about how these plants are spreading millions sometimes of seeds and perpetuating themselves, but then humans are also doing their part. How would you say we're doing with invasive species these days compared to years gone by?
I think we're doing better than we ever have been. The challenge, though, is that invasive species are very shifty. So we have to be as visionary as possible to try to change our messaging to make sure that people are aware of invasive species movement. So instead of talking about invasive plants now, we're talking about aquatic invasive species or invasive species in general, so that people are aware that invasive species can fall into any type of habitat or category. And then in terms of management, Doug already mentioned, we do integrated management when it comes to invasives. And that's because they can adapt to a type of management approach that you're doing if you use the same approach consistently. So sometimes you have to shift gears and try to adapt to what the invasive species are doing. So it really is adaptive management. And as long as you're staying on top of it from that perspective, lots of outreach and education so that you reduce the vectors for spread, and then really good strategies for control or management. You can try to stay ahead of the game, which I think lately the prognosis is better than it ever was.
Today on The Exchange, we're looking at invasive plants and what New Hampshire is doing to keep them in check. In New Hampshire, lakes, rivers, and ponds, non-indigenous plants have moved in, and they often choke out natural flora and fauna. But volunteers and state officials have taken up the fight against them. We're getting the latest, and we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. I think the term you used a moment ago, Amy, was the vectors for spread. We should probably talk a little bit about how these species come to New Hampshire in the first place.
Sure. The vectors are basically varied. They could be over land. They could be by water. They could be by birds, by deer, by moose. So when it comes to vectors, we always try to be aware of, you know, is a moose wallowing in the, it sounds odd, but is a moose wallowing in the shallows and picking up seeds that's attached to it that's bringing it to another water body? Is it one of the more obvious things like a boater who is moving things from site to site? So in the aquatic realm, it could be a vehicle that's moving things around. So you just have to be up to speed on all of them potentially.
So plants are carrying along, they're sort of hitching a ride, so to speak, on boats, on animals, birds, moose, sometimes with humans, and they sort of make themselves at home?
They do. Amy pretty much covered all the vectors. Soil movement is one of the biggest issues with Japanese knotweed, especially with roadway drainage ditches, highway maintenance, things like that. It only takes a little tiny fragment of root, about a half inch, to turn into a new plant. And those plants can become established very quickly. And unless it's detected and controlled quickly, that plant is going to cause a lot of problems. So what we're doing is trying to stop that by creating more education awareness, doing a lot of presentations to communities, getting the word out, trying to get these highway facilities on board so that they're following good practices. It's all about BMPs.
Best management practices.
Best management practices.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. Scott is calling from Plymouth. Hi, Scott. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Yeah. We have an infestation of Japanese knotweed, which you've been talking about for the last few minutes. I heard you say at the top of the show that you were able to control it up to 90%, which is about 89.99% more than we've been able to control it.
Uh-oh.
I wondered if you had any tips. We've tried, we've tried just essentially cutting it back. We don't like to use chemicals. We've even tried a weed dragon thing that shoots, you know, fire, and that didn't really even do anything. And then my other question is, you were just sort of touching on this. Even if we did get rid of it, our neighbor across the street also has an infestation of it. And so, what are the chances that it would be right back anyway?
Ah, two very good questions. Thank you, Scott. Doug, what worked when you were taking care of this and getting to that 90% level? which is which sounds like a beautiful dream at this point for Scott.
It is. It's a very optimum goal. It is very difficult to control Japanese knotweed. There are a couple different methods that we use. Non-chemical approach is smothering, cutting the plant down this time of year, cutting it close to the base, putting a cushion layer, wood chips, bark mulch right on top because those cut stems are woody, they'll puncture through plastic. Taking heavy, thick 7mm plastic, putting it over that area, extending that plastic about 5 to 7 feet beyond that cluster of knotweed, and then covering that over with bark mulch. Covering it over bark mulch prevents photo degradation, cold cracking, and it gets rid of that aesthetic eyesore. Most of my work entails herbicide application. And according to labels, using a very low percentage of glyphosate at about 5%, you can go up to about 27%. So I'm very low on that spectrum. I've tried 4%. Using this as a foliar spray to the foliage of Japanese knotweed late in the season. I try to hit the plants right after flowering. And I do that because I want to avoid honeybees foraging for nectar. I don't want to impact them. And it's also the time of year when carbohydrates are starting to migrate downward into the root for overwintering. And ultimately, what I'm getting is 95 to 100% control. Sometimes you do have to go back and you have to do a follow-up application.
And sometimes, Amy, he mentioned his neighbor has the same infestation. So it's also keeping an eye on what's around you so that that doesn't sort of creep back into his yard.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one thing to remember that when you're doing a management practice, you are taking the species that you're wanting to get rid of and getting rid of it. But if you don't revegetate, you might be leaving an open habitat for the invader to come back in, particularly if it's nearby. So especially on the terrestrial landscape, weeds will come in and grow very quickly. So it's important to try to go back in there and plant with something native so that you can cover that area again and add some competition.
So leave very little openings for these invasive species to try and worm their way back in.
Right. They do like disturbance, so they will go in any area that's disturbed.
Well, thank you so much, Scott, for that call. After a short break, we'll hear from more of our listeners. We'll also look more at the efforts to keep invasive plants in check in New Hampshire, both on land and on water. The exchange phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send your comments and questions through our Facebook page. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. You're invited to join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend this special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem on July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. It'll be turning partly sunny today, warm, high temperatures in the 80s, partly cloudy tonight. North Country could have some evening showers, lows tonight in the 50s. Sunny tomorrow, highs lower 70s north, ranging lower 80s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth summer lineup, including The Buddy Holly Story, Straight No Chaser, Left Bank Cabaret Series, Indie Cinema, and more. Tickets at themusichall.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, the fight against invasive species in New Hampshire. Call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. With us during this portion of the program is Doug Seigan, Invasive Species Coordinator for the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, and Amy Smigula, Limnologist and Exotic Species Program Coordinator for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. We've been talking about how these invasive species come to the state and then stay here and oftentimes perpetuating themselves at a pretty rapid rate. But what we'd also like to talk about during this portion of the program is how we're dealing with them. And one of the broadest efforts to keep invasive species out of New Hampshire's lakes is called the Lake Host Program. Joining me now with more on that is Andrea Lamoureux. She's vice president of the New Hampshire Lakes Association, and she oversees the Lake Host Program, which includes about 80 groups of volunteers working to fight invasive plants and animals in New Hampshire's lakes. She joins me by phone. Andrea, welcome. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for having us this morning.
Could you first describe what your lake hosts do as they see boats coming in and out of New Hampshire's lakes?
Certainly. Lake hosts are trained individuals. We have about 750 of them scattered at about 100 of the most highly used boat ramps in the state. And lake hosts are commonly recognized by a bright blue shirt, and it says lake host on it. And what they do is they meet and greet boaters before these boaters put their boats into the lake and after they take them out of the lake. And they strike up a conversation and talk to the boater about aquatic invasive species, both plants and animals. And they assess how knowledgeable the boaters are and then provide the boaters with some information on simple steps they can take to prevent the spread. And then they work with the boater to inspect the boat and the trailer to see if there's anything hitchhiking along that day. And if they find anything, they'll take it off and we'll bag it up and we'll send it over to Amy there at the Department of Environmental Services. And she'll take a look at it and see, you know, what we're finding out there.
So education with the boaters coming in and out of the lake and then observation.
Right.
So they're right. Not necessarily stopping someone and commandeering their boat for inspection, but it's a partnership more.
Yes, it's a wonderful partnership program, and it's educational. There is no enforcement. It's simply, you know, educating and teaching the boaters about this good practice that we're hoping that they'll use. We teach them to clean, drain, and dry their boats to prevent the spread of the plants and the animals. And we're hoping that once they meet a lake host and learn this, they'll always do it on their own, whether or not they meet a lake host the next time they go out and visit.
And has that effort changed over time? Do you find that boaters are now more knowledgeable about invasive species and the kind of best practices to deal with them than when the Lake Host program began?
Yeah, wonderful question. This is our 13th year. The program began in 2002. And really up until last year, we were really focusing on boaters learning about the plants, primarily milfoil, and how to prevent the spread of that.
Andrea, are you still there? It sounds like we lost Andrea for a moment. We'll see if we can bring her back. But I'll ask you, Amy Smigula, since she mentioned that the samples that the lake hosts are finding on boats come to your attention. How often is this then? How often are you finding these? Are you getting these samples from lake host program volunteers and staffers? And what kind of an impact then does that have?
So over the course of a regular boating season, usually from May until early to mid-October, I received several hundred samples over the course of the summer that lake hosts send in to me. And of those, probably we used to see a couple hundred invasive species coming in because some of the really high-use water bodies in the state used to have pretty bad infestations near their public access sites. But because of good strategic management, we've reduced the growths in those areas and we've been able to clean those up. So nowadays with the Lake Host program, we see anywhere from maybe 10 to 20 invasive species plants coming in out of those several hundred. So the rate of spread is being reduced, and that can also be supported by the fact that in 2013, we had no new aquatic plant infestations in a water body in the state. So it's a testament to the effectiveness of the Lake Host program.
And it sounds like we have Andrea Lamoureux back with us from the New Hampshire Lakes Association. Glad to have you back with us. I wanted to ask because I wanted to, I heard that your new effort on education is to work with canoeists and kayakers.
Yes. Yes, we are talking to canoers and kayakers about how they too can help prevent the spread of plants and animals by always cleaning, draining, and drying their boats. Basically, we're trying to prevent boaters, motor boaters, as well as canoers and kayakers now to prevent the spread of water from one system to another system. Because again, in the drops of water is where these larvae of these unwanted animals are usually present. So by always picking anything off you can see and then draining out the water and then drying your craft, that's the best way to prevent the spread of both plants and animals these days.
And finally, what are your hosts seeing or at least expecting to see during this summer?
Yeah, this summer our hosts have been out at most of the ramps for at least a couple of weeks. And so far, we've already had two official saves, which means hosts picked off two species of aquatic invasive plants. Both of these saves happened at Pawtuckaway Lake, and the plants that they found were curly leaf pondweed and water chestnut seed. So these are two two plants we've definitely seen hitchhiking around, and Pawtuckaway Lake in particular has had a number of saves over the year. So we know those species are out there, they're on the move, and we know our lake hosts are out there, so it should be a busy summer.
All right, Andrea, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
That's Andrea Lamro, Vice President of the New Hampshire Lakes Association. She oversees the Lake Host Program, which includes about 80 groups of volunteers who are working to fight invasive plants and animals in New Hampshire's lakes. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. If you'd like to join us in our conversation today about invasive plants in the Granite State, call 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Doug Sagan, Andrea mentioned the water chestnut weed or water chestnut seed, and I had been reading in the Nashua Telegraph about an effort on the Nashua River to try and clean that out, and a fairly successful one at that. What is it that it takes to take care of an invasive species that has choked up a waterway in New Hampshire? How big of an effort are we talking?
Well, I think that's a question for Amy.
I think in general, the effort needs to be consistent and strategically scaled to the size of the infestation. So both in the terrestrial realm and in the aquatic realm, you need to have a really good handle on the scale of the infestation. So you need to go out and you really need to have a good map of the area of infestation and then pick the correct strategy for management. For the water chestnut in the Nashua River, they had large mechanical harvesters out there for several days in a row, repeatedly harvesting this material, bringing it up on this conveyor belt type of device into a big hopper. And then they would bring it and offload it on shore where the Nashua Department of Public Works was transporting these big dumpsters full of water chestnut to a composting site. So there are many partners that are involved. There's a lot of time involved, and that material is extremely heavy. So you have to have a big site to deposit it and then manage it appropriately afterwards so you don't have material that's near a waterway that could get back in. So I think in terms of any type of management, you need to have a good solid plan, you need to implement it well, and then you need follow-up to make sure you did well.
And the training piece too, Doug, is key when you're talking about large groups of volunteers coming out and taking part in an effort to clean up something as large as the Nashua River, because with a plant like, say, purple loosestrife, where there could be thousands or even millions of seeds, you don't want somebody just sort of ripping it up and shaking it out. It's sort of the dandelion effect. If you pull it up the wrong way, it could just perpetuate itself anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest issues that we have is when you're getting into control measures and eradication, how do you deal with these invasive plants so you don't promote the spread? I deal mostly with terrestrial, the upland invasive woody plants. And in those cases, we promote the eradication and control during the time period when they're not in fruit. So before they set flower, before they're producing berries, before they're producing seeds, this material is not dragged across the landscape. If you're working in a site, work in the clean area. Then progress to the more invaded site, especially with the equipment. You have tracked vehicles, the lugs of your shoes, tires, things like that. They can all pick up soil, and there's a seed bank in there. So to prevent the spread of invasive species and to minimize it to the best of your ability, work in these areas in a timely manner, taking this material to a certain location, a depository where you can control it on your own property, whether stacking brush. A lot of municipalities, their transfer stations are creating depositories for invasive plants for separation. The worst thing is when you have generic material, say it's regular maple leaves, things like that, cleanup from the fall. But then people bring in invasive plants, and they're riddled with berries, with seeds. And that material is mixed in. That material is then composted, but it's not hot composted. It's cold compost. Cold compost will not destroy those vectors, those seeds, those propagules. Best method for that is to have it separated, bring that invasive material to another location, have it burned, have it hot composted, and deal in that way.
Let's take another call from one of our listeners. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Natalie is calling from Marlboro. Hi, Natalie. You're on the exchange.
Hi, thank you. I haven't heard any talk about using goats to control invasive species. And as someone who raises goats, I do get a lot of inquiries about that. You were just discussing, you know, seeds and dispersal. Well, goats have this unique ability to convert their food into energy very efficiently, and by doing so, they neutralize seeds. So when you use goats to use for brush clearing or for invasive species, they are not spreading those seeds through their poop pellets, which is real helpful. And, of course, then you're not using chemicals and, heavy machinery or anything like that. I mean, goats are pretty remarkable about, doing their job and doing it well.
Goats as invasive species control teams. Natalie, thanks so much for the call. Amy, we've certainly heard about goats being used to clear brush in different parts of the state. Have you heard about goats being used to try and deal with purple loosestrife or any of these other invasive species, perhaps?
I have heard of both goats and sheep being used to control invasives in different parts of the state. And they're sort of a great little tidy biological control, if you will. So I have actually quite close to my house seen goats and sheep used underneath power lines to clear terrestrial species. And it's a lot of invasive species that grow underneath the power lines. And yeah, they're great. You fence them in, you let them have at it, and you have a nice cleared area. And hopefully those pellets are taking care of the viable seed, and you're no longer able to spread those or have them regenerate from the waste materials of those animals.
Great question. Thanks again, Natalie, for the call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Doug, a question for you. Is the goal in dealing with an invasive species to eradicate completely? Is that a reasonable goal, or is it more about management?
It's essentially about management. Eradication, in some cases, is an option. We have a new establishment of ornamental jewelweed up in Warren, and this population is likely going to be managed and eradicated. We have a new outbreak of mile-a-minute vine and Japanese stiltgrass in one location because it's a new infestation. It's early detected rapid response. And with that, we can get control. It's just a matter of getting in there and doing the management practices very timely, very quickly, and constantly, as Amy pointed out, going back year after year for a few years until you know you have control.
And for some of these terrestrial land-based plants, one of the vectors that we haven't talked about really yet up to this point is that some of these plants were initially decorative and ornamental, and over time people realized this isn't probably the best thing for us, to bring in, say, plants at the holidays. And have we seen some changes in the plant growers and plant sellers so that we're not seeing the sales of particular species that have been troublesome, rather than simply state officials and volunteer groups saying, buy this instead of this because this one's invasive? Has there been a change there?
There has been a change. Both Doug and I work a lot with the retailers of aquatic and terrestrial species, and we both have prohibited lists amongst our different agencies for the species that we view as the biggest threat to the state. Some of the species that are prohibited are already here, yet many of them on the list are not yet here, and we're trying to prevent those species from coming in. Doug and I also do inspections of the retailers, and we want to make sure that they aren't selling those species that are prohibited, and we educate them constantly about making sure they're aware of their nursery stock or their aquarium materials so that they aren't bringing things in. A lot of people don't always follow the Latin name, which is sort of the law of the land when it comes to species identification, and they go by common name, which is often misleading, and they sometimes don't know what they're selling. So yes, there is still to some degree invasive species being sold in the state, but we have cut down on a lot of that through constant contact with the growers and the retailers.
We have an email here from Anne who says, my property has been overrun by locust trees. Although the trees are especially pretty in the spring, they have choked out all other vegetation. As I have started cutting away the locusts, I'm finding stunted apple, maple, and ash trees. Are locust trees invasive? That's her first question. Also, are invasive species nature's way of dealing with climate change? So a couple of different questions there, Doug.
Locusts we wouldn't consider invasive. We don't have it prohibited. We have sort of taking a look at black locust, not honey locust. They do have a tendency to produce numerous offspring. They can come in and outcompete a lot of the other vegetation, so it kind of ranks it up there into that invasive tendency. And they do have allelopathic chemicals, which are excreted by the root, which actually preclude other native species from becoming established or from, just being vigorous. That is a problem. And the earliest you can get in there and do your management practices, the better control you're going to have, the more ability you're going to have to restore that landscape into an area that is more desirable to what you're looking for.
So essentially a plant that is a native New Hampshire plant can still be difficult and crowd out
right.
Other plants.
Like poison ivy.
Like poison ivy. But what about that question about climate change that Anne was asking? Is that playing a role in the way that invasive species are growing or perpetuating in this state? Or do we not know the answer to that yet?
Climate change is actually really having an impact on species. We are seeing some species that were clearly tropical or clearly southern in nature and in habit moving up this way and overwintering where once they were not able to. So if we get a series of mild winters where we don't have great frost infiltration into the soil or good snow cover or ice really forming on the lakes, we may have a number of species that could overwinter and get a good foothold. And one of the biggest things about invasive species, and I think I said it before, is that they're quite adaptable. So once they get a foothold, they will adapt to the conditions that they are living in, and they will become the super competitor. So I think that climate change is a big impact. And one of the things that DES is doing is we are listing three new plants on our prohibited species list through upcoming rulemaking because they were tropical, but we are starting to see them overwinter in Illinois and in Michigan. So reports from my counterparts in those states is making me a little nervous. So I'm going to be adding three more species to our list.
Something to keep an eye on. As we wrap up this part of the program on invasive plants, I'll just ask you each one last question. You said each of you said that we're in a better state in dealing with invasive species than we've been in years past. What do you think would help turn the corner even further on some of these infestations? More resources, more people, more time, better rules, or some combination of any of the above? I'll start with you, Doug.
I think it is a combination of everything that you just mentioned. More outreach, more education, more awareness, more people volunteering, more people getting involved. There are initiatives like the Stewardship Network of New England. You can actually get onto UNH's Cooperative Extension website and volunteer. You can offer your support and services. Having towns and municipalities being more proactive in the way they manage of their roadways, their highways. Just getting more people out there being active.
So a little more of what you're doing all across the board, Amy?
A little bit more of what we're doing. And our mantra is prevention, early detection, rapid response, and management. So as much as we can prevent and as early as we can detect, the better off we will be in the fight against invasive species.
Well, I want to say a big thank you to each of you. Amy Smagula, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Brady.
That's Amy Smagula of the Department of Environmental Services and Doug Sagan of the Department of Agriculture. Thanks so much
for
coming in as well. After a short break, we're going to take a look at invasive insect species, and we'll hear about a new development involving the emerald ash borer. We'll also take your calls and comments. What questions do you have about invasive insects in the Granite State? That's the conversation when the exchange continues here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on Iraq and the possibility of U.S.-Iranian cooperation. Then, the legacy of James Joyce on the centennial of his short story collection, Dubliners. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather turning partly sunny today, warm with high temperatures in the 80s. Partly cloudy tonight, North Country could have some evening showers, lows tonight in the 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing repair for knees and shoulder injuries for UNH athletes, sosmed.org. And the Monchari Museum in Norwich, Vermont, presenting a T-Rex named Sue exhibition, a 42-foot-tall, fully articulated cast skeleton with engaging interactivities, open daily 10 to 5, monchari.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about invasive insects in the Granite State. And joining me now is Piera Siegert, state entomologist in the Division of Plant Industry at the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We've had some news this week about an insect known as the emerald ash borer. What have we learned just recently?
Well, what happened was a week or so ago, Kyle Lombard, who's with the New Hampshire Division of Forests and Lands, was putting up some traps in the Salem area. Salem has been an area of interest for us for at least the last several months because there had been an emerald ash borer detection in North Andover, Massachusetts. So we were preparing for finding something in that greater Salem area. And as he was putting up traps, someone just across the state line stopped him and said, I'd like you to look at my ash tree. So he went over and looked at their ash tree in Methuen and found that it was, in fact, heavily infested with emerald ash borer. So he contacted the appropriate personnel in the state of Massachusetts so that they could be aware of the infestation, and then contacted me and also began looking for emerald ash borer on the New Hampshire side of the line. And so far, we have not found emerald ash borer in any county in New Hampshire except for Merrimack County, but we are anticipating that we will be finding it in the greater Salem area soon. And that greater Salem area actually would incorporate potential detections in both Rockingham and Hillsborough counties. So what we're asking people in those areas, and I can list the towns here in a moment, is that they keep their eyes on the health of their ash trees in order to inform us if they notice something odd happening with their ash trees. Early detection means that you have more options in terms of management. And also we're asking them to keep their firewood as local as possible, to not take it with them when they go camping. And we are anticipating that we might find a detection in Rockingham and Hillsborough counties sometime in the near to longer future.
So the fact that this has been seen so close to the southern border with Massachusetts makes it very likely that if it's not already just over the border, that it will probably be so soon.
So the emerald ash borer can move in about three different ways. The first way that it moves is actually with the power of its own flight. And most emerald ash borer emerging females will lay about 90% of their eggs within about 100 meters of where they emerge. They can fly, but flight and dispersal of emerald ash borer through flight is really only a couple of miles a year. So on their own, they're not actually moving very far. And then the second way in which they move is that people are carrying them short distances. In firewood is a primary way that emerald ash borer moves. And that movement generally tends to be about 20 miles when it makes jumps like that. And then there also are some people who tend to move emerald ash borer very far distances, and that can be on the order of hundreds of miles. But those are more rare events. So it's really that middle distance of the 20-mile jumps where people are actually moving the insect.
You mentioned that people should be watching for something odd going on with their ash trees. Are there a wide variety of different oddities that could take place with an ash tree, or is there a typical sign where you know someone in your shoes could look at a tree and say that looks like an ash borer to me?
Well, for us, the best way, and in fact the only way that we've actually found emerald ash borer in New Hampshire and then this detection in Methuen, is by looking at woodpecker activity. So if you have woodpecker activity known as blonding, where the woodpeckers learn that there is emerald ash borer actually in the tree, they will go back to that same tree because it's an easy meal for them and just fleck off the outer bark and leave the lighter colored inner bark. And so that blonding is how we found the infestation in Concord, the one in Loudoun and Canterbury, and then this one in Methuen. This time of year, with the foliage coming on, the blonding is a little bit harder to see than it is in the winter, but you can still see it. And then ash trees do a number of things when they're stressed. They may do this for something other than emerald ash borer, but if you see an ash tree that has a thinning crown where the foliage just seems thinner than it should be, or if it has sprouts coming off along the base of the tree along the main trunk, that's known as epicormic shoots, that can be indicative of emerald ash borer. And then if you actually see a very small D-shaped exit hole in the bark or an emerald ash borer S-shaped gallery, those are absolutely indicative of emerald ash borer, but those are a lot harder to see than the actual blonding or the general ash decline.
So it's more likely that what you'll see are the signs of an emerald ash borer rather than the actual insect itself.
It is far more likely that you'll actually see the signs and symptoms of emerald ash borer than the beetle. You could get lucky and actually see the beetle, but in general, what you're going to see is your ash and decline. Ash borer adults tend to stay towards the top of the tree. They're feeding on the leaves. They're looking for mates. They're, especially in the early parts of the infestation, they're laying their eggs in the crown of the tree. They're not really coming down to the ground. We do have an insect that's a native in New Hampshire, and it's a good one to have around, known as the six-spotted tiger beetle, and it is a bright green beetle, and the spots are very small to see. So people, often when they call and say, I've seen emerald ash borer, and I tell them it's probably a tiger beetle, they tell me, well, there's no spots on it. But we do get a lot of calls about that one at this time of year. It's a ground beetle. You'll often see it in open, sunny areas. So that's our biggest call of people sighting emerald ash borer when it actually isn't.
I wanted to come back to a point you made about firewood. You mentioned that people should start using firewood from as local as possible. And that was one of the tightened rules that came into effect when the infestation was spotted in Merrimack County. Well, actually, several infestations, several spottings. How does that help control the spread?
Right. So firewood is the number one way that emerald ash borer is actually moved from area to area. And especially, I have a lot of people telling me about ash makes such good firewood. You can cut it down green. You can burn it clean. Well, when you are moving that firewood from place to place, it's actually keeping those emerald ash borer larvae and pupae in a good and healthy situation. They can continue to grow. And then when you take it to a new location, if the wood doesn't get burned right away, they can emerge. If you're moving it at a time of year when the insect is about to emerge from the firewood, they can actually emerge en route and start new infestations. So the movement of firewood and a long-distance movement of firewood is very problematic, and it's really how this insect has spread across the country like it has, starting in the southeastern portion of Michigan. It's now in 22 states, from as far west as Colorado, then to the northeast and as far south as Atlanta, Georgia, in a very short period of time.
Now, what else is part of the playbook, for lack of a better term, controlling the firewood? What else do entomologists and other environmental officials do to try and keep that infestation from growing any further than it already has?
Well, the outreach is really important. And the more educated that people can be about emerald ash borer, the better the situation is. The earlier you can report it, the earlier it is detected, the more options you have. The Division of Forests and Lands is really in charge of the management effort for emerald ash borer in the state. And they have implemented a number of management techniques in the greater Concord area, including treating ash trees with insecticides in order that any eggs that are laid on those trees do not develop into larvae, so that knocks down the population. Also, they have been engaged in the release of some biocontrol agents that specifically target emerald ash borer eggs and larvae in order to reduce populations.
And we should mention, since this is something that affects the ash population, which is significant in this state, this is, as well as an environmental issue, this is an economic issue.
It is. And it is estimated to cost, a conservative estimate, between $121 and $250 million for New Hampshire in dealing with emerald ash borer by 2019. That was based on some work that was released a few years ago. And in that work, they actually were overconfident in how long it would take emerald ash borer to get to New Hampshire. So they had estimated it wouldn't enter the state until about 2015. And while we found it earlier than that, so populations will be larger, more areas will be impacted. So those numbers are likely to go up. And the reason that those costs are so high, and that is actually strictly just municipal trees and homeowner costs, the reason that those costs are so high is that ash has been used as a landscape tree. So emerald ash borer isn't just a forest pest or a forest industry pest. It's actually a pest for homeowners and municipalities in the state who, when emerald ash borer is detected in their area, will have to decide what to do with those ash trees, whether or not they're going to treat them with insecticide, whether or not they'll remove them, and whether or not they'll replace them. And all three of those activities have very real costs associated with them. So the cost to you or to a municipality from emerald ash borer really is dependent on how much ash you have in your inventory. There are communities in the state that have a very high inventory of ash, and it will be a very expensive problem for them. There are other communities which have a fairly low inventory of ash, and so it's not as much of a concern.
And one last question on this particular beetle. I mentioned the playbook, the different techniques to try and deal with it. How well has that been going in this initial infestation in Merrimack County? And what does that tell us, maybe optimistically or not so much, about what we may find then if we do end up seeing the emerald ash borer in southern New Hampshire?
Well, I think it's a little hard to tell at this point as to how well it's been going. We just found emerald ash borer in Merrimack County last year. We're only a little bit more than a year out. they only have one generation in a year, and so it's hard to tell what impact we've had. If you ask me that question in 5 years, I might have a better answer for you right now. What I can say is that New Hampshire and the northeastern states in general have been very proactive about emerald ash borer. They've been looking for it in different ways, both by doing outreach and asking the public to report, by putting up traps, by putting out what are known as trap trees, where they girdle a tree to make it more attractive to emerald ash borer, and then they take those trees down in the fall and they peel them looking for galleries, and also by use of a biosurveillance wasp that feeds on emerald ash borer and brings it back to its nest. And so if you know where these wasps are, you can watch to see what prey is being brought back, and you can find emerald ash borer that way. So we've been really proactive about looking for it, and quite frankly, the infestation that we found in Concord, we found it about as early as you can expect to find emerald ash borer by a visual survey. So we're on top of the detections of emerald ash borer, and then it's cooperation from the public for doing reporting and for not moving firewood and for paying attention to quarantines, as well as the management efforts that have been implemented.
I'm making a note right now to ask you in 5 years.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll come back in 5 years.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're taking a look at the latest efforts to keep invasive insects in check in the Granite State with Piera Siegert. She's state entomologist in the Division of Plant Industry at the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. And let's talk about some of the other insects. What, other than the emerald ash borer, are you working on these days that maybe isn't getting the headlines that that particular insect is getting?
Well, I don't know in terms of not getting the headlines. One of the other ones that people talk about a lot at this time of year is Asian longhorn beetle. We have never found Asian longhorn beetle in New Hampshire. People are largely unaware of that, I think, because we have a lookalike insect in the state, which is a native and which is not invasive and is not a threat. It's called the white-spotted pine sawyer. And it is very active between about Memorial Day and the 4th of July. They're not considered a threat because they are laying their eggs in dead and dying pine trees. They're not attacking healthy trees, so they're not bringing healthy trees down. But because they look so similar to Asian longhorn beetle, we get a lot of reports, and Forest and Lands gets a lot of reports, and the nurseries get a lot of reports, and everyone is reporting.
You see the big horns, and you think,
yes,
uh-oh.
Yes. The reassuring thing for people is that if we had Asian longhorn beetle, and that would be a big if, it really should not be active until mid to late August. So the timing of the emergence of these two insects is very different. So you should not be concerned if between Memorial Day and the 4th of July that you are seeing Asian longhorn beetle. It is far more likely to be white-spotted sawyer. But anytime you have a concern, you can upload a photo to nhbugs.org and someone will identify it for you.
I was going to say, it may end up being more work, but it might end up being more useful on your end for people if they see something to say something.
I'd rather identify 10,000 of the wrong insect than one of the right ones.
Than
so
one of the right
certainly
ones.
Send a photo.
And once you implement these rules for a particular invasive species about, say, transmitting, bringing in firewood from out of state, or inviting people to pay close attention and identify species, is it just a matter of watching and waiting, or what do you and your colleagues do? As far as just keeping an eye on different groves of trees in different areas of the state to spot something that maybe an individual might not spot?
Well, we do have several traps that go up in the state. We've got about 450 of the purple panel traps for emerald ash borer out this year. And those have gone into all counties except for Merrimack. That's a federal program, and it's a program designed to find emerald ash borer where it has not yet been detected. It's been found in Merrimack County, so no traps in Merrimack County. And then there are about 50 what are known as green panel traps that the Division of Forests and Lands has purchased, and they're putting those up in areas of high concern for emerald ash borer, like the Salem area, which is how this detection in Methuen happened. And then there are programs with landowners who may be concerned about emerald ash borer, where they can volunteer an ash tree on their property to then be girdled and to be treated as a trap tree. And as I said, these trap trees are actually really effective at finding emerald ash borer. They release stress volatiles. The emerald ash borer respond to those stress volatiles. They lay their eggs in those trees. The larvae develop, and then they can be taken down in the fall and peeled to look for signs of emerald ash borer. There are some volunteer programs for wasp watchers to identify these biosurveillance wasp colonies, where then people can go and volunteer their time to look at what these wasps are bringing back to see if they can find emerald ash borer. And there are also some high-risk areas, too, like campsites and things that various agencies across the state do go and periodically check to see if they're seeing any declining ash. But really, a wonderful way to find these populations is for people to report signs of blonding or ash decline and then have follow-up checks on it.
To notice that something is looking
right.
different than it was before and to report it then.
The more eyes, the better.
In that same spirit, the fact that in the emerald ash borer's case, it was coming through other states and then made its way here means that New Hampshire conceivably has the benefit of that experience in Michigan or the Midwest or other places.
Absolutely.
And what's worked and what hasn't worked.
Absolutely.
There.
By the time that emerald ash borer was found in this state, we know so much more than they initially knew in Michigan. Emerald ash borer was first detected in 2002 in Michigan. It had probably been there since the mid-1990s, and there was no global knowledge, really, of this pest at that time. So pretty much everything that we know about emerald ash borer has happened in the last 12 years, and it's really been worked out in the Midwestern states of Michigan and Ohio. We have now insecticides that we can use against emerald ash borer. There are what are known as SLAM programs, slow ash mortality, in order to reduce the spread of ash mortality and in order to reduce those costs. We have trapping techniques that had never happened before. And so we are sitting in a better situation at being able to at least reduce the costs associated with emerald ash borer than anybody was in the Midwest.
And last question for you. We are sitting here together 5 years from now talking about the emerald ash borer or any of these other invasive insects. What would you like to be able to report back to the Granite State? They're completely gone or they're completely controlled or...
I don't think I'll be able to report either of those things back.
Wishful thinking, maybe.
I think what I'd like to be able to report back is that the people of the Granite State are aware of emerald ash borer, that they are making their decisions about their ash trees and how they want to manage their ash trees, and that they are looking at their budgets and doing the right thing for them.
That no blonding will be left unspotted.
No blonding will be left unspotted, and that we have slowed it to the best of our ability to slow it.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure thing.
That's Piera Siegert, state entomologist in the Division of Plant Industry at the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on the state of New Hampshire farming. A recent survey shows the number of farms in the Granite State is on the rise, bucking national trends, although our farms themselves are getting smaller. Meanwhile, this year's federal farm bill presents opportunities and concerns for New Hampshire agriculture. We'll dig into the latest with Granite State farmers. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Hillsborough House, a locally owned nursing facility, improving the experience and delivery of rehab and residential care for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org. And Cooper Cargill Chan, attorneys invested in the people and organizations doing business throughout the region. Offices in North Conway and Berlin, coopercargillchan.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook,
90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Reed. Iraq's biggest oil refinery was said to be on fire today after an attack from the Islamic extremist group ISIS. The militants have already taken over large areas in Iraq, including several major cities. President Obama meets today with congressional leaders on the U.S. response.